when I was in Afghanistan, every day when we went on a mission, anything bad that came of it, we chalked it to like, we're working for a better tomorrow, for a better future, for our comrades, our soldiers, or, you know, our battle buddies who died there. We were doing this for a better tomorrow. If we went to some Afghan's home and we, you know, searched their house for weapons or for somebody we were looking for, we chalked it up to like, hey, we're doing it for a better tomorrow. We're doing it for the girls' education. But what happened today, and when I see Afghanistan today, it infuriates me. Why did we do all of that if we were just gonna go back to the Taliban that were there in the first place?
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. Before we get started, I wanted to ask you, as I usually do, if you would do me a personal favor. And that is, if you enjoy this content, please like, share, and most importantly, subscribe. It really, really helps us with the YouTube algorithm, and it helps us get the word out. Well, I am very, very pleased today to welcome Safi Raouf to the show. Safi has an amazing story. Safi's story, in my view, is really the culmination of the American dream. He was born in a refugee camp in Pakistan in 1994, and then as a teenager, emigrated with his family to the United States, where he became, later on, a hospital corpsman and a linguist for the U.S. Navy. Safi graduated from Georgetown University on a pre-med track and then was accepted to medical school, but he elected to defer medical school so that he could return to Afghanistan to help people who needed the most help. He founded Human First Coalition, which works to evacuate refugees from Afghanistan. In December of 2021, while providing humanitarian relief in Kabul, Safi was detained by the Taliban and held for 105 days. He was subsequently released in early April 2022, following negotiations between the Taliban and the Biden administration. Safi, welcome to the show. You have a lot of guts, and you have that unique, special thing where you feel compelled to help people before helping yourself. I want to first, even before I ask a question, just say you have my deepest respect, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure's mine.
And likewise, John, I've read your story and it's incredible. I applaud everything you've done.
Thank you very much for saying that. Thank you. Well, I want to start with just a quick overview of Afghanistan. The United States spent 20 years in Afghanistan. We weren't wanted. We weren't needed. We hadn't been asked to rebuild the country after the initial response to the 9/11 attacks, but we made a decision, at least the Bush administration and following subsequent administrations made the decision to go to Afghanistan, to stay there, and unfortunately to kill or displace a lot of people. So here we are 24 years later. Tell us what Afghanistan is like today. Is it better? Is it worse after the U.S. Occupation?
It's a complicated question. If we look at it, what Afghanistan was 20, 25 years ago, it was the infrastructure or basically everything that we have in the modern world that didn't exist. It was almost if Afghanistan was living 100, 200 years in the past. Today, we do see Afghanistan as a country that's been rebuilt, that has roads, that has infrastructure, electricity, internet, people have access to the world, people have access to Facebook, all the social medias, and they do get a lot of their information from there. On the other hand, it's also far worse. When we invaded Afghanistan in 2001, Taliban were fighting with AK-47s and beat up Hilux trucks. Today, they have over $90 billion worth of military equipment. That includes Humvees, that includes MRAPs, that includes planes, that includes M4s, all our modern technology or modern weapons. So what if you look at Afghanistan when Taliban first came on August 15, 2021, and you compare that to today, you see the downward spiral of Afghanistan into more people are becoming more conservative. Especially the Taliban fighters, they're becoming more conservative. There's more. So we can't see it right now, but what is Afghanistan going to become in the next 10 years?
Yeah. You know, this is something I struggle with, and I'm glad to have you on the show because you're not just Afghan American. You have worked and lived in Afghanistan, and you've seen the ugly side of Afghanistan. So I've come to say that the Taliban did not descend on Afghanistan from the moon and come down and, you know, from outer space to settle Afghanistan. These are the fathers, the brothers, the sons, the husbands of Afghan women who have taken over the leadership of the country. The United States was there for more than two decades. We gave the Afghan people an idea of what a Western-style democracy looks like. They didn't want a Western-style democracy. There was no historical precedent in Afghanistan for a Western-style democracy. They had the Loya Jirga system that they were happy with. And in the West, we looked at these, well, what I would call atrocities that were being committed by the Taliban against the Afghan people, even against Afghan history and heritage, let's say the Bamiyan Buddhas, for example. But at the end of the day, they chose the Taliban. Can you explain that? I think this is something that most Americans don't fully understand.
Absolutely. This is exactly how I put it. It's ironic that you used the exact same words, that Taliban didn't come from like some outer space, other planet. You know, they are from that land. They are from Afghanistan. They are 99.9% of Taliban are from Afghanistan. They are those people. And when I say that, that's where we went wrong. That's where America went wrong. You know, in 2000, until 2006, 2007, there wasn't a significant insurgency in Afghanistan. Taliban laid down their weapons, went to the mountains or to their homes or to Pakistan. What happened was America undermined the Taliban or the people of Afghanistan. They thought they're going to go arrest, send them to Guantanamo, torture them. They're going to kill their family members. And the people aren't going to do anything. Taliban came back into existence because the American atrocities, because of the atrocities that the government that was installed by America because of them. If you look at so I spent a lot of time at the U.S. embassy in Kabul, and I was with JSOC at the time, and you know, with those teams, we used to go to the annex, which Ariana, the CIA station there. And if you look at that geography, the station is basically inside the presidential palace. So how ironic is it that the CIA station is inside the presidential palace? So who is running the government? At the time when Karzai was the president, and what he was trying to do is go and reach out to those people who had started some insurgency, and that included Mullah Brother, that eventually the U.S. reached an agreement with him, the Doha agreement. He was trying to reach out to him, but what happened? You know, what happened there was Mullah Brother was arrested and put in jail. Instead of him coming and Karzai, they sitting together and talking and figuring out a way forward for the country, they arrested him. They tortured him. He was in jail for many, many, many years. And eventually, he was released at the request of the American government, and he was flown to Doha. And the American, Mike Pompeo sat down with him and reached an agreement without the say of the Afghan people. So you kind of think who was running the government. Was it just a puppet government in Afghanistan that the CIA was running and doing whatever they wanted to do? So we go back to that. We didn't involve the people of Afghanistan in deciding what their future is going to be. And you put it exactly how I would put it. They didn't come from Mars. They were living there. Their families were there, their houses, their children, their parents, their wives, all of them, they are from Afghanistan. And what we did is we chose one side and completely ignored and brutalized the other side. And that doesn't go well. You can only push somebody so far.
It's exactly the same mistake we made in Iraq in 2002, where as soon as we crossed the border, we said that nobody who has ever been a member of the Ba'ath Party may participate in government. Well, everybody was a member of the Ba'ath Party. And most of them joined the Ba'ath Party because they were forced to. It was the only way that they could work and earn money to feed their families. We just made it worse. I wanted to ask you too, I'm still thinking of these stupid mistakes that we made in Afghanistan because we didn't understand the culture and we didn't understand the country's history. I remember I was still at the CIA at the time where the US military made a decision that it was going to fight corruption in Afghanistan. And so the way they were going to do that was if you were a member of a certain tribe or a certain family, you were not permitted to serve in the Afghan military or police in that area. So if you were from Helmand, for example, they sent you to Herat, right? Or you were from Kandahar, they sent you to Jalalabad. And what ended up happening is local residents just said, I don't know who this guy is. He's not from this area. He's not from my family. He's not from my tribe. I'm not going to pay any attention to him, and I'm not going to do anything that he says. And law and order fell apart. Am I just misremembering this? Or was this a problem that led to bigger problems vis-a-vis law and order?
Absolutely. It was, you see, even here, let's take an example of America, right? If we descend on American cities and American towns with heavy military that is from another state, and we go to everybody's homes and round them up in the middle of the night, people are not going to just sit down and watch that happen. It's an inherent quality or inherent people don't just take and keep taking. At some point, they're going to rise. And you said we made this mistake in Iraq. It's not just Iraq. Every country we have ever gone to, like go back all the way back to Vietnam, Korea, even, you know, in the 90s, during the Cold War, every South American country, just the list goes on and on. We don't go and learn what the country is about. And then we figure out we involve those countries. First of all, like when we were conducting operations, even we were conducting operations with our partners that were the Afghan military, we didn't share intel with them. We were like, oh, this is, you know, top secret SCI. We can't share this with you. Or if we were, it's ridiculous. It's their country. They know the geography. And you are right. Afghanistan has a very, very specific culture. It has very specific norms. And for Afghan people, what is more important than their life, it's their dignity. Mm. Mm-hmm. And when you send somebody who they don't know, they'll fight them. They'll fight them till death. They're either going to win or die. There is no option for them if you send some stranger that's going to just go into their house. And we did that for 20 years. We'd go in the middle of the night. They're all sleeping. Helicopters come in, you know, surround the house. You go in, you turn their house upside down. You harass their woman. You harass their children. You take their mail. And, you know, 3 days later, you release them because they didn't do anything. Absolutely. I've been on over 1,000 over 1,000 missions in Afghanistan over a four-year period with Rangers, with Delta, with SEALs. And I almost 80% of the missions that we went on, it was just false information. What happens when you go to a country that the people desperately need money? What they're gonna, you tell them, hey, if you send us this information, we're gonna pay you this much money. And what happens is everybody is gonna tattle on everybody. It's either for money or personal grudges.
We filled Guantanamo with false information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's people who spent a decade in Guantanamo, and all because of false information.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the things that we saw here in the United States in the immediate period before sending combat forces into Afghanistan was reporting about Afghan women and girls being denied educations. They're not allowed to read in public. They're not allowed to sing. They have to have the permission of their father or husband before leaving the house, etc. Has any of that changed? Is this a new, more modern kind of Taliban, or is this the Mullah Omar era Taliban just come back to power?
It's completely, they're going back to where they were,
wow,
you know, before 9/11. All the schools that were built by the U.S. for the women, they have all been closed. Women can't work. They can't go outside the house. They are making it, every day it gets worse. That's what I said is like, just comparing the Taliban that is today to the Taliban from 2021, who made all kinds of promises. What happened with Mullah Brother? Mullah Brother was sort of the middle of the road, sort of he was going to compromise on some things, but they sidelined him. He was supposed to be the leader of the Taliban when we sent him to Kabul, but now he's completely AWOL. And now the Taliban who are ruling are from Kandahar. Those Taliban that are the descendants of Mullah Omar, those who don't believe in girls' education, those who don't believe in women's rights, those who don't believe in women working, those who think that women should stay at home and they're basically just for bringing children. That's what they think, and that's today's Taliban. And it's extremely concerning. And you see, when I was in Afghanistan, every day when we went on a mission, anything bad that came of it, we chalked it to like, we're working for a better tomorrow, for a better future, for our comrades, our soldiers, or, you know, our battle buddies who died there. We thought we were doing this for a better tomorrow. If we went to some Afghan's home and we, you know, searched their house for weapons or for somebody we were looking for, we chalked it up to like, hey, we're doing it for a better tomorrow. We're doing it for the girls' education. But what happened today, and when I see Afghanistan today, it infuriates me. Why did we do all of that if we were just gonna go back to the Taliban?
Just turn it back
that
over.
Were there in the first place? And you know, Every Al Qaeda member that we looked for, eventually we found them in Pakistan, or we found them.
Oh, of course,
else.
Of course. I made a career out of hunting members of the Taliban and Al Qaeda, and every last one of them was in Pakistan, all the way up to Osama bin Laden.
Exactly, and they weren't just, you know, sometimes they're like, oh yeah, they're in the tribal areas and just, mm-mm, you know. They are not. They're sitting in Islamabad. They're in Rawalpindi. They're in Lahore. They are in Peshawar. You know, I went to school in Pakistan. Every Friday prayer, when you would come out of the mosque, right outside, there was somebody sitting, had their boxes open, tens of people collecting money for Mujahideen, for the fighters in Afghanistan, for Taliban, for fighters in Kashmir, for fighters in every fight that was being fought from a religious point of view. And you look at that, and even today we're like, okay, so what should we do with Afghanistan? Let's ask Pakistan. And it's just, Afghanistan is a very complex country. The people are very complex, and it needs complex solutions. It needs the people who understand Afghanistan. Afghanistan, back in the days when there wasn't a lot of transportation and people weren't really mingling together, you would go 30 minutes from your town. The next town, they were a completely different people.
Yeah.
If you look at, you know, there's a town that speaks Pashto. You drive 30 minutes, the next town, they speak Farsi.
Yes.
You drive another 30 minutes, they speak Uzbek. You drive another 30 minutes, they speak like Tajik. You go, they speak, you know, Pashai, which is, you know, in eastern, southeastern Afghanistan. It's crazy to think that you can go into a country and just lump them into one category and think you can you can change that. It's millions of people. You can't just go and harass people, brutalize them, and you think the people are going to accept you, especially a country like Afghanistan.
You know, before I get too far afield, I have to ask you about the recent border skirmish, I guess we could call it, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The numbers of people killed and wounded varied wildly from as few as a dozen to as many as 200. But the fact of the matter is there was a lot of shooting between Pakistani military and Afghan military. What happened to relations between the two countries? How did this skirmish take place?
Well, it's been... It's a very long.
Yeah, what surprised me when I was there was in what high esteem the Afghans held the Indians, but didn't say the same thing about the Pakistanis.
Well, if you look at Pakistan, it only came into existence in 1947. It didn't exist before that. And if you look at it, when the Brits came to the subcontinent, that whole area was called the subcontinent. It included India, current day India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. It was a huge chunk of area. And when the British decided to go further north into Afghanistan, they got their asses beat.
Yes, they did.
You know, there were
historically
they sent 200 British soldiers. Every single one of them got killed, and they left one person alive. They left one person alive who was a surgeon. They left him alive who was also shot in the leg. They let him live, and an Afghan person actually let him live in his house, gave him shelter in his house, and it was in Khost province. In Khost province, an Afghan let him into his house, nursed him back to health, eventually dressed him in his own clothes and smuggled him across the border back to his British government. So that's also things that Afghan people do. You know, Marcus Luttrell, who was captured, his team was killed in Afghanistan, and he found shelter in an Afghan person's home, and eventually he was rescued. So those kind of things have happened historically. And, we're just veering off the subject. But what happened, the British, what they did is they basically told that Amanullah Khan was the person who was ruling Afghanistan at the time. They made a pact with him. They were basically like, we are not going to come across the Durand line, and you guys are not going to come to the other side of the Durand. And the Durand Line was named after the person who did the agreement. Well, what happened is that agreement was set to expire in 100 years. And it did. So the land that goes all the way to almost bordering Islamabad, and then on the Quetta side as well, this land all belonged to what was that day Afghanistan. So the Afghans have never accepted that border. And the people that live on both sides, they share more with the Afghans than they share with the Pakistanis who speak Urdu. That part of Pakistan, they all speak Pashto. They have same culture. They share. They intermarry with each other. They have relationships. They are the same lineage, same tribes, but they're just divided by an imaginary line
created by the British.
created by the British. And what happened there was that those people, because they also share the same sort of culture, same rules, the Pakistan didn't really understand what to do with them. And for the longest time, they were self-governing. They didn't send the military to rule that area. It's the village elders, the village leaders, they were the ones ruling those areas of Pakistan, the northwestern frontier province. It wasn't part of, and it wasn't, it didn't belong to any, it didn't belong to any of the provinces either. It was federalized lands that were self-governing. But what happened after 9/11 is a lot of the Taliban went to hide in those areas with their relatives, with people they knew. And we started drone strikes in those areas and started killing people, started, you know, doing drone strikes on weddings, doing drone strikes on family gatherings, on houses, funerals, everything. And those people became fed up and they started fighting back against the Pakistani government. And that's when the Pakistani government sent their military. And the insurgency, I was actually in Pakistan at that time. And that's when the insurgency started. That's when the Pakistani, the TTP, the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban sort of came into existence from a local sort of struggle of the people themselves, the wazir from Waziristan, from Parachinar, from Khurram Agency, from Khyber Agency. They all created small movements to fight against the Pakistani government. And that is going on till today. So what they do is they, Pakistan claims that some of those leaders live in Afghanistan. So they conduct airstrikes in Afghanistan. And in most of those airstrikes, they kill civilians. And that's how it all started. And the Taliban were like, we don't have air power, we don't have long-range missiles, but we can fight on the ground. So they just went and they couldn't be stopped. Pakistan has a really, really strong military in terms of air power, in terms of long-range missiles, but they can't fight the type of guerrilla warfare that Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan can do. So when the Taliban started just going on the ground and doing small group attacks, the Pakistani military was taken by surprise, and a lot of their military posts were overtaken by the Taliban. And then what Pakistan did is they used long-range missiles and air power to conduct airstrike on civilians, on homes. So it's not that it just came into existence. It has existed since the creation of Pakistan.
The Russian government announced recently that it was preparing to reestablish diplomatic relations with Afghanistan, which is a major move. There are very, very few countries around the world that have a diplomatic presence in Kabul. For a fleeting moment, Donald Trump toyed with the idea publicly of reestablishing relations with the Taliban. That has come to nothing. It likely will come to nothing. What do you think that this new relationship between Russia and Afghanistan means? And do you think other countries, especially countries like Iran, like China, like India, will normalize relations with the Taliban?
You know, India has also said recently that they're going to establish diplomatic relations with Afghanistan. In fact, reopen their embassy in Kabul. And ironically, Pakistan was the first country who opened their embassy in Kabul, and they still have their embassy open in Kabul. Russia has had presence in Kabul since the beginning of the Taliban, since August 15. It's a very complicated relationship between Russia and Afghanistan. Russia is in a bad place. Russia is in a very bad place right now. And Afghanistan is a country that historically a lot of countries has wanted to be present there. The Chinese are there right now, but the Chinese have a really complicated way of working with different countries, especially what they're doing in Africa, what they're doing in Pakistan. Afghanistan is not like that. China goes to a country, they're like, we're going to give you $1 billion, but they're not giving them $1 billion. They're basically buying
infrastructure
of their country.
Yes.
Yeah. And that doesn't work with Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. So China figured that out and they decided not to invest in Afghanistan at all. So now Afghanistan is going to Russia and they have had talks for the last 2-3 years. And, you know, Russia, if they establish true, real relationship with Afghanistan, it could be a good relationship for both sides. Afghanistan has a lot of natural resources that Russia really needs right now. And Afghanistan doesn't have a lot of money, a lot of equipment, and they could be beneficial to both sides. But Afghanistan and Russia has a very complicated relationship, and I don't think it's going to work out between them. And there is all the other Russian Russian countries that separated in the 90s. All of those countries, Russia is kind of getting more foothold in all of those countries, like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, all of those countries. Russia is slowly getting a foothold. They're sending their troops there. Even when the Taliban took over August 15 of 2021, the border along the Tajikistan border along northern Afghanistan and along Uzbekistan, the Russian soldiers came to secure those borders. It wasn't the Tajikistan or Uzbekistan military themselves. The Russian military came and secured that border. So it tells that it kind of shows how much control Russia has on those neighboring countries to Afghanistan. So it's a Russian movement further south.
Well, and it's
getting more countries.
It seems to be more strategic in its formulation than what the United States has come up with. I wanted to ask you too about something that's been very important in your life, and it continues to be, and that's the situation with the refugees. There are Afghan refugees, thousands of Afghan refugees who are now being pushed out of Iran back into Afghanistan. The Pakistanis have never wanted large numbers of refugees in Pakistan and have begun pushing them back into Afghanistan. So what's the situation with refugees now? Is there really any hope for them? Or do you think that for the most part, they'll be returned to Afghanistan, whether they like it or not?
Well, if you look at those refugees, there's not just thousands, there's millions.
Millions,
there's
about, literally millions.
Mm-hmm. 1.4 million in Pakistan. And that's just official numbers. There's more. There is over a few million in Iran as well. And if you look at these people, they have been in those countries for decades. They were all born in those countries. The people who immigrated to those countries, they're dead. It's their children. So Pakistan and Iran and most of the countries in that region, almost all of the countries in that region, when you immigrate from another country and you have children there, your children don't automatically become citizens.
That's right. There is no birthright citizenship.
There's no birthright citizenship. You have to have generation from going back to hundreds of years in that country in order to become a citizen of that country. It doesn't just happen if you're born there. So all those children, they don't even know Afghanistan. Some of them don't even speak Pashto. And they have gone to school there. They have jobs there. They have businesses there. If you go to Lahore, some of the biggest businesses in Pakistan are owned by Afghan refugees. They have clothing businesses that they import from China. And in Lahore, they have the biggest businesses. Similarly, in Pakistan, they have some of the biggest businesses there. They're billionaires, millionaires that are Afghan refugees. And what is happening right now is their businesses are being taken from them by force, and they're being sent back to Afghanistan. I think the biggest issue with that is going to be for Pakistan and Iran themselves. You know, if you ask me about Pakistan, I know every corner of Pakistan. I know every street. I know every city. I know all of their military garrisons. I know where their ISI is. I know where nuclear program is. And it's the Kahoda, which is in the mountains going on the road from Peshawar to Khurram Agency. That area, they have their nuclear program there. So all of these refugees, they know exactly what Pakistan is, their geography. So sending them back to Afghanistan is a really bad move on their part. It's if they lose everything they have in Pakistan and they're sent to Afghanistan with nothing and they have no way to move forward, it's a very easy recruiting population for TTP, for the Pakistani Taliban. And similarly for Iran, it's a very easy tactic for the Taliban to recruit them for all from all different groups. Al-Qaeda, it's a good recruiting tactic for Al-Qaeda.
The Israelis recruited hundreds, maybe more than hundreds, of Afghan refugees in Iran to report back to them.
Absolutely. And, you know, those the people that we trained, that were trained by SEALs, by CIA, that were trained by Delta Force, by Rangers, there were thousands of them. There were thousands of special operations that we trained and taught them how to use all of our weapon systems. They're easy recruits for any organization, for even the Taliban that are in power right now, and some weapon systems that they can't use can easily be used. In their intelligence department, in the Taliban intelligence department, they weren't able to use a lot of the SIGINT equipment that we had given to them, the CIA had given to them. The Taliban couldn't use that. But eventually they learned, because some of the people that were working in the previous government eventually had no choice but to go and join the Taliban and teach them how to use that.
You're exactly right. I'd like to ask you also about your own harrowing experience. You had been doing this kind of work for a long time. You're there on the ground in Afghanistan, and then you're arrested. Tell us about that, what that was like.
You know, it's being in that situation is, it's like, I'm sure you have your own experience, but it's being taken against your will, against, and put in a place that you have no idea what's to become of you. They put a, you know, they cover your face, they put a bag on your head, and you feel like you're being, you know, paraded to your execution. And that was the fear every day. And the hardships on one side, but what you are thinking that whole time, it's more psychological than it's physical. The physical is easy. That's not hard. You get beaten up, you get it's cold, you're sleeping on the bare floor, you are tied, or you have your hands tied, or all of that is easy. What is hard is the psychological aspect of it, day in and day out. One, they don't give you any information. They don't tell you why you're there. They don't tell you how long you're going to be there. They don't tell you what you did wrong. And just you are just there. You are at their mercy.
And you don't know if you're going to be released next week or tried and sentenced to 50 years in a dungeon somewhere.
Absolutely. That's the number one sort of psychological torture, where you have no idea what the future holds. Are you going to be there for a day, or are you going to be there for the rest of your life? And, you know, we did that to a lot of people. We did that to a lot of people. The director of intelligence who was holding me, he would often come in, because I didn't just sit there. I didn't just sit and, you know, take their, I was a fighter. I like got up and fought with all of them. And I made their life really hard. So their chief comes down, the director of intelligence, Abdulhaq Wasiq, and he comes to me and he's like, do you know how long I was in Guantanamo? He's like, 13 years. He was in Guantanamo for 13 years. He was released in exchange for Bo Bergdahl.
Oh my God.
So he was one of the five released in exchange for Bo Bergdahl. And he would come down to me and he would often be like, do you know what they did to me? He's like, they would release dogs on us. They would like let the dogs bite us. And he's like, you are living the life. This is nothing. And sometimes I would think about that. And my argument was, you guys were in a war with a country. Today, you have signed an agreement with that country. And as a citizen of that country, you have no right to hold me. You held Bo Bergdahl for many years. You held Ferreter for 2-3 years. You held many, many American soldiers for many years. And that was justified. You were fighting with a country. They were holding you. You were holding their people. But today, you've signed a peace deal. And you can no longer hold me. In order to calm me down, they would often send these people who had spent time in American prisons. And they would talk to me and they would tell me about their time. And you kind of humanize them. They become human to you. They become real. You know, when I was fighting with JSOC in Afghanistan, I didn't think Taliban were real. They didn't feel real people. They didn't feel like they were existing as humans. They were, you know, it was just, we thought there were like maybe 5,000-6,000 of them, and there were 5-6 in every little village, and they were just trying to fight with us. But when I went to Kabul and I saw their organized soldiers, like full thousands of military, fully trained and were able to stand like soldier stands, I was taken so far back. My mind couldn't comprehend that. It was, how did these people have organized thousands of soldiers when we were claiming that we have pushed all of them out of Afghanistan? Where were their training centers? How these people were training? Who trained them? Specifically, who trained them? Who? I saw these guys like wearing our helmets with night vision goggles and the weapons, the M4s that had sights on them, the night vision sights, and they were using them as if they have been using them for many, many years. And in that place, I learned so much about the Taliban. You know, I went on a hunger strike for 9 days, and that was an interesting experience with them as well. The Taliban didn't want me to die.
I'm sure.
They wanted me to stay alive and be a token for the Taliban to, you know, negotiate with the Americans. And Taliban were very curious. They couldn't figure out who I was. But what was really interesting to them is everybody was asking about me. You know, the Biden administration was asking directly. It was coming down directly from the president. And they were asking the Taliban about me and asking them to release me. And they kept looking at who I was. They looked at everything. There were a lot of interesting things that actually happened. And one of the most interesting thing is, so the first day when they were going through all my stuff, one of the Taliban guy, he pulls out my wallet and he's going through all my IDs. And stupidly, he pulls out one of the ID. It's my Navy ID. It's my military it's my CAC. And he looks at it, then he looks at me, he kind of smirks, puts it back, puts away my wallet, and I never see that again.
What in the world?
So this guy doesn't take this military ID that has my picture, that has my name, that clearly says I am uniformed forces, and he puts it away. I never see that again. He doesn't give it to his superiors. He doesn't give it to another Taliban guy. He doesn't tell a soul. He puts it back, closes my wallet, and puts it away in a drawer. And when I'm leaving, he gives the wallet back directly to me. And I leave. And I'm like, did this guy just help me? Yeah. And why?
Mm-hmm.
And why? Why did he help me? Was it just a human? Was it just being a human and he just wanted that I don't get in more trouble? Or was there something more?
So tell us a little bit about the conditions in which you were held. Were you treated with respect, at least?
So it was, everybody was different. There were people who were very disrespectful, who were calling me a traitor, who were calling me CIA agent, who were calling me all kinds of things. They thought I was a spy. I was working for the CIA. And then there were those that I became very, I started connecting with them. I started learning about them, about their families. So the senior guard who was for my prison, he was a older, probably his late 20s. And I asked him, are you married? Do you have children? He's like, I just got married, but I don't have children. I'm like, why do you not have children? He's like, oh, well, I was a suicide bomber and my turn never came. So I didn't want to marry mm-hmm. because I was suicide. I was going to go conduct a suicide.
That's attack. Very thoughtful of him.
Yeah. But my turn never came. And now that I don't need to be a suicide bomber anymore. That's why I got married. And now I'm going to have children. And it was, you learned about these people. You would think that a suicide bomber would be some strange guy who's out of their mind,
right.
Who has like no sort of, you know, control of his own thoughts or body or his own actions. No, it's just a normal guy. A normal guy with like, you know, just believes in it.
Yeah, right.
So I was living in a basement for the entire time. We were in a basement that was about 12 feet below ground. And I didn't see the sun for about 70 days. And finally, when the negotiation was going farther, they started taking us out into the sun because they were like, we don't want you to look too pale when you guys get out of here so you don't look bad. So people don't think that we were like keeping you in a basement. It was one of the facilities of the back in the days, what's called NDS, which is the National Directorate of Security, that the CIA directly trained and equipped and worked with. It was that department. Now it's called the Directorate of Intelligence. So that's where I was held, in a basement. It's inside that green zone, which also includes the presidential palace,
yes.
The CIA annex, which was called Ariana or the CIA annex, and also very close to the U.S. embassy. And it was in a basement the entire time I was there. And, you know, eventually we bribed one of the guards who brought us a phone. We were able to use that phone to tell our loved ones that we were still alive. And it was winter, and you know, Kabul winters are really cold. Initially we didn't have blankets or, you know, mattresses or any kind of heaters. So I was wearing this jacket it was a red jacket. It was really warm, and I never took that off for the 105 days, and it never got washed. By the end of it, it looked great.
Yeah, like it could get up and walk away on its own too.
Yeah. 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 So that jacket was a lifesaver.
Wow. Last question for you is tell us about your release, how it was negotiated, how it was implemented. How did that happen?
So there were many different false agreements that happened and then it didn't go through. What Taliban wanted, they didn't want anything in my return, except they were like, we just want American diplomats to come to Afghanistan, shake hands with the Taliban, and we'll release him. That was it. And what they wanted to show is legitimacy. So that whole plan, when the special presidential envoy was going to come to Afghanistan to for that and get me, take me back. So they did the whole planning. They sent like a whole troop of Navy SEALs to Pakistan with helicopters and everything, so that if anything went wrong, they could intervene and carry out a rescue mission for the special envoy. Well, what happened 5 days before he was supposed to come to Afghanistan is Taliban basically announced that everywhere in the country, girls above grade fifth couldn't go to school. So America was basically like, oh, we can't go now. So the administration walked back. And then we had a 40-minute long call with Wendy Sherman and Nita Lowey, Wendy Sherman, several other senators from the U.S. called the administration and basically compelled them to carry out the mission and not walk back. Well, what happened is the special envoy couldn't come at that time. It couldn't be a public visit. So ironically, what happened is the CIA station chief from Doha decided to come. And what happened, what their intention for that visit was to establish a relationship with the Taliban intelligence, CIA and Taliban intelligence, so they could cooperate in eradicating ISIS. And, you know, that relationship is still there to this day.
You get little bits and pieces of it in the media every once in a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that relationship that started because of my release is still, which I find, I didn't know about this, but it was leaked in New York Times by whoever. It was leaked that the CIA station chief came to get me out of Afghanistan.
What a story. Well, glad you're back here.
Thank you.
Tell us where people can find more information about the work that you're doing.
So the organization I run is called Human First Coalition, and we actually run a school for girls in Afghanistan, and we also continue to provide humanitarian aid. We can't do it to the same level that we used to do, but we are trying to start more schools for girls, education. That's our goal now, and humanfirstcoalition.org is a nonprofit, and anyone can find it on the internet.
Any thoughts of going back to medical school?
I think that's too far in the past. I think that ship has sailed. You know, I grew up on Top Gun and I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And what the goal was, I was going to become a doctor. And Navy has this program called a flight surgeon.
Yes.
Is you basically, you are a doctor, but also you go to Florida and you learn how to be a pilot. So you are both a doctor and a pilot.
It's pretty
great.
That
was the goal. It's great, but I think that ship has sailed.
That's okay. You're doing very, very important work. Safi Raouf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning into another episode of Deep Focus. We love having these conversations. We can only do it because of you. Thanks to you. So please like, share, and most importantly, subscribe. We appreciate it very much. All the best.